Welcome to Forget the Box, the ultimate web series podcast. I'm your host slash steerable community director, Brie Castellini, and today we're tackling Post. My guest today is Joshua Caldwell, director, producer, writer, and MTV Movie Award winner. We talk about a few editing tips and tricks, how to set yourself for success on set and make sure that you have the coverage that you need to make a complete project, and whether or not you can actually, quote unquote, fix it in post. Welcome to Forget the Box, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us who you are and what you make?
Yeah, so my name is Joshua Caldwell, and I am a filmmaker, writer, director, producer. I am a cinematographer. I edit, kind of jack of all trades, mostly focused on lately feature films and digital series.
And you worked with Black Box TV for a while?
So years ago, I was an executive for Anthony Zeiker, who created CSI. Basically, in addition to our TV business, he was also very, very interested in digital when digital yet wasn't a thing. It was sort of pre-iPad. iPhone had just come out, like, when I started working there, but he had this really intense interest in doing something in that space. And so we had done a few things, and then I can't remember the exact order of things, but at some point we came in contact with Tony Valenzuela of Black Box TV, and we'd heard about him and met with him. And at some point, YouTube came out with their $100 million apply to be a channel initiative. We talked to Tony and we said, hey, would you like to, or actually he came to us and he said, would you guys be interested in partnering with me on Black Box 2.0, get Zeiker involved and pitch. And so we did. And it was a rather interesting experience for me, but we got to produce a lot of content and make some, you know, fun little shorts and things like that. It was like a part of my other job, which was working for Zeiker and sort of handling digital stuff for him.
Cool. And so that wasn't your first digital experience?
No, it was, it's weird to call it digital, but we had done a project called the Digi Novel. The title of it was Level 26, and essentially it was a book and a movie experience in one. And so this was pre-iPad when he came out with the first book, and basically the idea was read a chapter, and then you come to a chapter and it says, log into this website, input this code, and you get to watch the next chapter. A somewhat clunky experience, because if you're on a plane reading this big hardback, like hardcover book, you can't really log in.
Oh, so it was a physical book. It wasn't like a blog post.
It's a physical book. It was published by Dutton. and there was a website connected to it. And then there was this whole idea of like doing community and like, you know, blogs. And that's kind of how I sort of got involved initially, was through a buddy of mine who worked there. He was like, hey, you do a blog, like, you're a filmmaker, like, come in and help us out. And I sort of weaseled my way in, because the person that had edited the first books, they called them cyber bridges, had left, and they needed to prepare some deliverables. And I said, well, I can do that. And then that kind of got me in. And then that eventually got me, you know, sort of a full-time job as a digital exec. And then after the first book, it was a 3-book deal. So we were starting to work on the second book, and then that's when the iPad came out. And then we designed a whole app experience, which is really the most organic version of that. But that was sort of this loose digital, I guess, basically non-television, non-film experience.
And transmedia, so, very transmedia.
Yeah, and I mean, I came from wanting to make traditional narrative features. And mm-hmm. so at the time, like, YouTube, the idea of YouTube was really not a thing. You know, it was sort of people just putting up skate videos and things like that. And mm-hmm. it didn't really seem to make sense to, you can make a web series, but I didn't want to be a web series guy. And so, but then I just kind of kept finding myself in these like digital scenarios. And at the same time as sort of I kept playing in the space, you know, you started to see a transition from quote digital to just content.
So you talked about it briefly. You also talked about it at Steerable Fest, where you were a guest.
Right.
You can check out those live streams at our Facebook page. But can you talk about how you started working in film? Like, what was the first step you took to, like, say, I'm going to do this professionally? What would you consider that first step to be?
Well, I mean, my desire to work in film goes all the way back to high school. We had a really cool program that had like Avid editing systems and digital cameras and like all the stuff. And so we got to just make movies and do it like you know, this is when like Final Cut 1.0 was out and people were still trying to figure out how can you even edit on a computer. Like you had a very specific setup, you know, you had to pay $1,000 to get the Avid Express DV, but it was cool because it was like that first, oh, you know, now today kids have it like so easy in terms of like being able to get equipment, you know, you can edit, make something on your phone, and we couldn't do that. And so we had to really like find a way to jimmy stuff together, you know, applied to a couple film schools, didn't get into some, eventually ended up going to Fordham University in New York, where while I didn't study film, I grew up in Seattle. I wanted to live in New York, you know, and I thought, oh, it might be better if I just move to New York, be in that area, be around all these people doing this stuff, and I'll just make my own movies for way cheaper than I would have to pay for, you know, any kind of like film school film, you know, where there are a little bit more rules. And so I did, and I started making a lot of shorts, and I eventually made a short film called The Beautiful Lie, which I won an MTV Movie Award for in 2006. They had a cool award for like 2-3 years that was called the Best Film on Campus. And so I was like the first recipient of it. So it was really cool because I was actually on the show, whereas like later the people that won it didn't get to go up on stage or anything. And so I got a golden popcorn at home and all that stuff. And so it was really cool and fun and like somewhat stupid because like who cares about an MTV Movie Award? But it's a fun little point of pride. Like instead of goat, I'm going to go after goat M. But goat. There you go. But anyway, so that was kind of great. And then I said, oh, let me move out to LA and the doors will be open to me and they're going to hand me the key to the city and I'm going to be a 23-year-old director and making my first movie. It totally worked out. No, I mean, it was a real great lesson because I think everybody moves out to LA thinking, oh, I've got the best idea in the world and they're going to give me a lot of money and I'm going to make it. And I'm 23 and, you know, I'm blind ambition, I guess. It just became a really great lesson in like, no, you don't have all the stuff and you need to work hard at it and you need to work on your craft and nothing's going to be handed to you. And if you're going to succeed in this, it's going to be up to you. And so I kind of, you know, put the MTV Movie Award under my bed and, you know, tried to get past the ego of it all and just dove into really working. So did music videos and, you know, did odd jobs and took internships and, you know, everything that I could and kept writing. Like I would write at night, did that for a number of years and then worked for Zyker for a couple of years and got experience in there and got to know people at like CAA and big companies and big brands and had that experience and eventually decided that around when I was 30 years old, I was like, you know what? I had a goal of making a feature before I was 30. You know, initially it was like, okay, I can make it for like 1.5 million, right? And then like, oh, I can make it for a million. And then 500,000, 300,000. You kept going down to try and find money and find a film that you could make. And it was around this time that I started hearing about what Ed Burns had been doing with like his $10,000 movies and shot on the Canon 5D. And I'd been doing like with Black Box and some of the digital stuff, we were doing a lot of shooting on 5Ds. And, you know, people would see what I was doing and they were like, that looks really great. Like looks better than the other thing that we're working on. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay. Like maybe this is like a real format, like that we could actually do something on. And so, you know, I decided that I wanted to write something that I could make for 10 grand, had this idea of a woman stuck on a layover in LA and kind of started developing it out from there. And it became the story of this woman, Simone, who's traveling from Paris to Singapore, visit her boyfriend. She has a connecting flight in LA that's canceled and she is stuck in LA for 12 hours and kind of becomes this journey through the night as she is facing down sort of a life decision about which direction her life's going to take. And eventually the film was called Layover and we made it for 6 grand, shot at night in LA over like 12 days, like weekends, like just with friends. The film premiered at the Seattle International Film Festival and got nominated for a 5 Prestige New American Cinema Award. And that kind of kicked everything off in a weird way because the film's like very indie. There's no stars in it. It's in French. 95% of it's French language. Okay. But people were really impressed by the idea that we had made it for 6 grand, which to me wasn't very impressive because it's like a small drama. What would really cost you money? But the ability to shoot on the 5D really opened up a whole, I mean, as it did for a lot of filmmakers, it opened up a whole new world, especially at night. And after that, I got offered to do a series on Hulu called South Beach. And following that, I did a movie called Be Somebody, which eventually sold to Paramount. And then my third movie, Negative, we made with Mar Vista, and that came out digitally last September.
Great, and that's a great place to kind of jump off of. So you have done quite a bit of editing, especially for shorts, I saw. But I noticed you don't really describe yourself as an editor. Is that right?
Right. It was funny. I was thinking on my way in to talk to you about this because I don't talk about post-production a lot. But I started, you know, in high school, the basis of everything was editing. Mm-hmm. As much as we were shooting, you know, a lot of it was going out and shooting, you know, a lot of it was editing because we now had this nonlinear editing system in Avid and you could really dive into it. And so a lot of those early years were like learning about like Walter Murch and Blink of an Eye and like kind of editing techniques and things like that, stuff that I've really carried over. And so just throughout the years, I largely edited my own stuff because I always said that the reason why I would do that is I couldn't find an editor that was better than I am that would work for less than I would, which is free. So, you know, but at the same time, that gave me a lot of freedom in the shooting of it because I was like, well, I know how I'm going to edit this, you know.
Yeah, and that's something we're actually definitely going to talk about because I think a lot of people, especially when they're new to film, don't realize how much of editing takes place on set and how much of like paying attention to what you're going to eventually do really needs to be taken care of there. So in sort of the most general sense, in your mind, what does good editing look like? Like, how can somebody who's never really dipped their toes in identify something that is well edited?
I think that good editing is somewhat seamless. And even in its most kinetic, frenetic way, even like in the jump cut. I mean, you think of like the most classic cut in the history of film, or one of the most classic in the history of film, which is, you know, in 2001, where you go from like the bone to the spaceship. And that to me is what you're looking for, of not noticing it. And it's challenging. And I think a lot of that has to do with rhythm. A lot of that has to do with pacing. A lot of that has to do with, like, I mean, even going back to the Walter Murch thing where you talk about where are people blinking. So even now that I've worked with editors, as much as I can, I try and get on the system and do it. And at least for like the last couple cuts, like I'm just doing it myself. Because I found that, but particularly for the stuff I shoot, it can be the difference between a cut working and not working can be a frame. Are we allowed to swear on this?
Yes.
Okay. So the term that you hear a lot is frame fucking. And basically, like, what I do is I go in there and I just like literally try all these different frames to say, like, well, where's the right cut, right? Like, the bulk of it's been done. I can take this time to really massage the cuts and get them right so that they feel seamless and they feel not jarring, because you can tell when something's hitting you weird. You might not go, oh, it's the editing,
right?
But you know that something's affecting you oddly as you watch something. And so I go in there, and when people have looked at my stuff and they say this is well edited, it's because I was able to get on there and really fuck with the frame and where it's being cut. I tend to shoot a lot of like handheld and a lot of frenetic stuff, and I do some longer takes, and so it's not as simple as like, oh, I'll just cut and paste it together. And mm-hmm. The skilled editors are always looking for that, and they're always finding ways to make a cut disappear.
And that's a great way to jump in, because the first question I had was about coverage. So is there such a thing as too much coverage?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, you read the horror stories of like covering a scene from 100 different angles. And look, I mean, what's your process? You know, is your process shooting a lot of coverage and then figuring out in the editing room? Is your process like you're on a show and you're kind of required to do it? Like, you know, are you Ridley Scott where you're shooting every scene with 5 cameras? Like, that's what he does, you know? But he's also operating with massive budgets and really long schedules, and he can do that. And that's a system he's developed over the years. Like, he wasn't shooting Alien with 8 cameras.
What does too little coverage look like in your experience?
To me, too little coverage is actually too little takes.
Okay.
It's less about the angles, and it's more about having, to me, it's more about having like the performance, you know? And the places where I've really been boned is in places where we just didn't have time to shoot enough takes and really get a great performance. Like, the way I try to do it, I usually have a pretty good idea of how I'm getting into the scene, like the shot that I'm using to get into it.
Okay.
And then I have a pretty good idea of the shot I'm using to get out of it. And then kind of in between, I shoot some coverage, you know, like I'll get enough that I can sort of cut around and I have some freedom and I have some place to cover up mistakes. But a lot of that is really just working it and getting the performance and trying some things with the camera. Like, I bounce around, you know, so I try to light at least 180, if not 360. I really am trying to get away from anything that's like constraining the actors. I tend to prefer shooting myself, so I'm able to make adjustments. And that just puts me in a place where, you know, I'm actually able to get quite a bit because I'm just bouncing around. And it's a little bit of that Robert Rodriguez where like every line of dialogue is a different frame. When we were shooting Layover, I mean, we'd go out to like a parking lot and we would find the parking lot would basically be lit. We wouldn't bring anything else. Maybe our DP would have like a little handheld light, but we'd shoot a bunch of takes of like sort of the things I wanted. And then I'd shoot some alternate angles or try something different, or like I'd be inspired on the day and say like, let's shoot this, or I need to get this little moment. And because we'd be up and running in 20 minutes to shoot like a 6-page dialogue scene, you know, I'd have 8 hours to shoot, you know, and so we just shoot for 8 hours. Totally. What I like to do is sort of know that I have my way in, know that I have my way out, and then give myself some options in the middle.
So like transitions is where you really have, like, that's where a lot of your planning, it sounds like, comes in.
Do you have any advice for planning for those transitions?
It's thinking about what's come before, even if you haven't shot it. It's sort of always giving yourself handles, so to speak, like, you know, okay, giving yourself a little bit in the beginning, you know, maybe you want to cut in a little bit later than you thought. Just giving yourself that breadth to choose the right entry point. Trying to just do the work ahead of time to think about that stuff, even if you don't know what the bulk of it is going to look like. You know, like, I tend to leave myself a lot of freedom in how I'm going to shoot something, but like sometimes you just have those images, and a mm-hmm. lot of them are that beginning and end, and thinking, well, okay, what's happening in the scene prior, what's happening in the scene after. I think a lot of people call cut too early. You want to give yourself room, even if it's weird that the actor is just standing there not saying anything. You just got to have that space. So mm-hmm. a lot of it also comes down to the taste and style of the filmmaker.
Do you have any other tips for just like being on set? So like not calling cut too soon is a great bit of advice. It also, I think, allows your actors to feel a little more ownership over the actions of their characters. Because if they only know what is literally written in the scene, like that's not super connecting to it. But it's like, hey, what is your person doing as soon as this line is said?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, for me, you're trying to largely get the actors away from acting. We do a lot of prep work, and I really try to get them to exist as the character. Not improv, but like if these weird moments come up, they don't break. They don't know not what to do. They're not actors coming in. They're like literally just delivering their lines. They're mm-hmm. really trying to live the character. And part of that experience is then translated on set. It's weird because once you're on set, it's sort of too late. what always bothers me, it's getting a little off topic, but what always bothers me about a lot of sort of the traditional approach to filmmaking, especially in indie features, is that what you're trying to do is you're trying to mimic the production setup that much more expensive movies have. Try to mimic a $100,000, $100 million movie with all the crew, with all the trucks, with the same type of approach. And what always suffers is your time. And what that translates to is time for actors to be acting. And that's the only real reason you're there. You're not there for the trucks and the catering and all this stuff. Like, you're not there for like these insane shots that like aren't really telling a story. You're really there at the core of it is to have actors acting. Everybody tends to be so focused on continuity, and that's mm-hmm. like the bottom.
So yeah, let's talk about fix it in post. Let's deconstruct it in post. What can you fix in post, especially considering most of us have zero money, or you know, maybe $500 to throw a post?
Yeah, I mean, again, I would say rent a cheaper camera and put more money into post. You know, everybody says it, a lot of people ignore it, is your post sound is probably more important than your picture. Audience will forgive not great looking cinematography or not a 4K or 8K image, but they will not forgive bad sound. I am extremely protective of the sort of on-set production sound that we get. You know, unless it's in a really extreme situation, like I feel like lavs sound way better than the boom. And I get in the mix and I get rid of the boom. And I'll use it for like backup. Mm-hmm. But what I'm looking for is super clean dialogue. And right. I never get that with the shotgun.
That is so interesting, because every sound guy I've ever worked with, they're like, you know what? I'm not even going to use the lav sound. I only want to use the boom. It's just so much of a richer sound.
Yeah, I think it's bullshit. I don't know why. And I've yet to have somebody convince me otherwise. It's really about getting what you need to get. Get the room tone. Get the little detailed, you know, things. Go out and shoot it yourself if you have to. Mm-hmm. You know, and really just focus on getting the best dialogue, you know, the cleanest, clearest dialogue that you can, mm-hmm. because that'll make your mix like so much easier.
And if you can get Foley on set, it's always better than trying to recreate it later.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, who really has a budget for Foley? Sometimes you gotta do it yourself. I did this short. I had no money for a post. I had a guy that would mix it for nothing, but I said, you know what, but I'll take care of all the Foley and all that stuff. So like I literally would just do it myself. And mm-hmm. you know, took time to do it. Again, like time's your best friend. You know, if you're not in a hurry, if you're not in a rush, like you could spend 2 months just cutting your own Foley tracks.
So that's actually a great segue into a question from our community.stareable.com from filmmaker Jules. So Jules asks, I always tend to edit footage as soon as possible so I don't have to worry about losing it or something. Do you think it's a good idea to enter post-production as soon as possible? Or do you think you should just let things sit for a while after production before getting started?
Depends on your thing. I mean, you know, you have stories now about Soderbergh, like getting off of shooting, you know, The Nick, and he's got a laptop in his hands with the day's footage, and he starts editing the scene. He's got the scene cut by the time he gets home. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I've gotten to a place now where as an editor, like I try to avoid doing the assembly. I try to have somebody else do that, because it's just like, if you're directing and you're writing and then you're shooting it and then you get in there and you're trying to edit this like crap together into something coherent and good, it's frustrating, mm-hmm. you know? So sometimes it's nice to have that break, but maybe it means starting right away, but having somebody else do it. I think taking a break from it's a luxury, you know, and if you can afford it, great. But there's no real right or wrong. I mean, I think that if you're doing everything and you're editing it yourself, sometimes it's nice to step away from it. The thing is about production is like, it's when you're spending the most money and you have the least amount of time. Like, you have time when you're editing. You have time in post. Like, you don't have that on set. Like, on set, the clock starts ticking and your bank account starts going down. And so you want all of that energy and time focused on that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also, I will say, Jules, I'll let you know that next week's episode of Forget the Box is actually about how to market before you have a thing to release. So if you're worried about how long your post-production process takes, don't, because we have a whole episode about marketing it before you even release a single episode. Internal plug, et cetera, et cetera. All right, is there anything that you have found that you definitely can't fix in post?
I found some issues with how much you can push an image in terms of color correction.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I mean, we did a scene in negative where we were in the car. Negative has a lot of driving stuff. And we did a scene where I'd mounted the camera to the front of the car and we were sort of shooting this like two shot. And, you know, we couldn't afford like a whole rig where you're like, you know, putting black over the window so you're not reflecting the sky and like all this stuff. And I had, because of the fact that the camera was kind of like mounted, it was a very secure mount, but it was kind of out on the end of the hood of the car.
Right.
I don't know why I thought this, but we were shooting on the C-100 going out to the Atomos Shogun. And I was like, I'm not going to put the Shogun on here. Like, because I'm worried about it. I think it might fall off. So that shot was like one of the toughest shots to color, because it just like every time we started to push it too much, it started falling apart, started looking grainy. It didn't match the rest of the scene. And I remember just with our colorists, like kept coming back to it being like, maybe we need to start over and like do it again. And so like, you know, really stuff that's like, you know, unless you're on a red and you've got like huge dynamic range, like, you know, try and there's always a limit to how much you can push things in post in terms of like that kind of stuff. So I like to try and get close to what the final image is going to be like, so that we're within range of that. I think like people underappreciate how much visual effects is used nowadays for stuff that you wouldn't even know was there. There was a great one that came from the company that worked on Sicario, and they sort of showed all the shots they did. And you're just like, oh, that was a visual effect shot. That was a visual effect shot. I did a short called Dig, and the actor was holding a gun for like most of the film. And we had three different versions of the gun. We had like a full blank firing gun that was we could only use on the day when we had our like prop master there. And he was doing me a favor, so he could only come out one day. And then we had like the matching metal one that didn't fire. And then we had a plastic one or rubber one or something for like stunts. And I remember one of those, the barrel was plugged, and it was something we didn't notice until we got into color. And so like we had to go in, because and the tip of the gun was different. Like there was a sort of a silver ring around the actual real one, and then the other ones didn't have that. So we had to like kind of cut that out and then motion track it onto the barrel of the gun, because otherwise it was clearly a plugged weapon.
Right.
You know, so it's things like that. Like, you know, there's a lot of lot you can do now with that kind of thing. It's a little scary, like just how much, you know, because I come from the world of like, if it's on camera, that's what it is. You know, it's like not a whole lot you can do with color or vis effects or anything like that. And so, you know, I always tend to shoot with like trying to be as close as I can to like what the final thing's going to look like, be it color, be it, you know, the color of what people are wearing in it, all that kind of stuff, because I don't like to leave it to chance and I don't like to leave it to post. There's quite a bit you can do, but like know that going into it, know what it is that you can get away with going into it versus like just that's the figure it out in post part. That's like so dangerous, which is like we don't really know what the solution here is. So let's just delay. Let's kick that can down the road.
Awesome. All right. So the last thing I kind of want to do here is I want to just do some really like quick tips for editing tricks that, you know, newbie editors might not think about, but that are so simple that anyone can do. And so as an example, something that I learned was about J cuts, as I believe what the term is, which is if you just cut on people's lines, like, this is a shot of this person saying this line, this is a shot of this person saying this line, I'm done. But instead, like, layering that, so maybe one person's line starts on the other person's coverage,
right,
changes the entire, like, look and feel of your film.
I remember hearing, I always think of it as the dragnet approach, which probably nobody knows what the show is. But there's a show back in the 60s called Dragnet, which is a cop show. And it was one of those where, like, every line was on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Walter Murch might have talked about it. But, like, that's that exactly. Like, every line's on screen. It just, like, really feels stilted and weird. And all
that's
that
the editing you can see. That's not seamless.
Exactly.
So do you have any quick tips, something like that?
What's interesting about this conversation, I've never been interviewed about specifically about editing. So I haven't really, like, developed that, like, conversation.
Answers.
Yeah.
Another thing, maybe this is a little bit more directing focused, but is something that you do sort of directing in editing, is something that somebody told me recently about a film that I was editing that was more dramatic than I was usually working on, was know whose face matters. Whose face is important in the scene and in every single line? Who do we want to watch experience this moment with us, and make sure to cut to them?
Yeah, and one thing that I would say is, like, you know, be open to it changing even from how you shot it.
Okay.
You know, like, what I like to do is always approach when I'm in the edit room is, like, even if my editor has edited a scene, like, I'll sometimes just start over. And not because he didn't do a good job, but because I need to find my way into it. And I need to have an understanding of, like, what's available to me, what kind of performance is there, like, all that stuff. And so I rarely reference the script when I'm editing, like, because the script doesn't matter. Like, what did you shoot? That's all you have to work with, like,
totally,
ultimately. And so it's also about being open to, like, little mistakes. I would say definitely, like, you know, as much as you can, like, watch your footage, like, look for those little short ends, look for those, like, after you call cut, before you call action. 'Cause there's sometimes a lot of little bits of gold in there, you know. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing too in editing is, like, just feel free to try things. I mean, that's what's great about nonlinear editing systems now, is you can just, like, really play with it, you know, and be kind of wild with it and challenge yourself. And certainly the geography of the room is important, which should have been figured out in shooting, but sometimes it's not. And so in editing, it's like, well, how does the geography work? You know, people always freak out about eye lines. They're far less important than a lot of DPs will make you think. If it's clearly from an angle where they shouldn't be looking, then that makes sense. But a lot of times, like, if you're alternate angles, they're always, like, freaking out about it, and it's like, let's just keep going. Like, they're still looking at the person. Like, what does it matter? The best thing you can do is, and these aren't really quick tips, this is the harder work, which is just having a fundamental understanding of your scene and going back to look, you know, as a writer would, like, who wants what and what are they willing to do to get it? And kind of reasking those scenarios and not just assuming that they're there, and not just, like, sort of laying it down as you shot it. Really approaching it saying, okay, now I have all these raw materials. You know, how do I construct this into something that makes sense? Because often you'll find something better than what you might have thought. When you have a real fundamental understanding of your story, that ends up working itself into, like, your process, you know, subconsciously. And so that affects how you shoot things, that affects how you frame things. Like, you don't know why you shot this, like, bird flying off, but now it's become this symbol of, like, her freedom for whatever. It doesn't matter, but, like, you know, sometimes, like, you just want to be open to that kind of stuff.
Totally. And that might be a you know, a point in the favor of maybe waiting a little bit after you edit, like, to the question earlier. Give yourself the time so that you don't come in with preconceived notions. Like, some are great, some are things you've planned, but sometimes you just want to not think about, like, what you thought you were going to edit, and edit what you actually have.
What I find is, especially as a director editor, or a director editing his own stuff, like, obviously it's, like, really annoying, really difficult to, like, dive into certain things. So often I'll just cut, like, the scene I was looking most forward to seeing, or I'll cut, like, my favorite scene. And so that starts it on a positive and sort of gets me into it. Because sometimes it's just about, again, it's like a writer facing a blank page, right? The editor facing the blank timeline. Like, sometimes it's just about starting to get stuff down. You know, the other thing that happened to me was really interesting, or the short that I made called Dig that I referenced before, it's online, you can check it out. I had this beginning written out, which was essentially, so the premise of the story is that it's about this young kid who is a Holocaust survivor, and takes place in the 60s, and he's in this cafe in Los Angeles. You know, he's sort of escaped Europe. He's come to live with his you know, distant family, and he is in a cafe with some friends, and basically, like, in walks the Nazi that killed his family. And so he ends up following him, kidnapping him, taking him out the desert, and orders him at gunpoint to dig his own grave. What follows is this kind of, like, little morality tale. It's like 26 minutes long. I'd had this opening originally conceived as this really cool montage. You know, he's in this study session with classmates and they're talking about Nietzsche and like all this stuff. And it was going to intercut with like, you know, the guy in the back of the car. And I sort of had this in my head when I first conceived of the idea and first conceived of the script. What happened was I then wrote the script, but I didn't, it's really hard for me to write sort of these montages where you're cutting from thing to thing to thing. Like, so what I'll do is I'll just write each individual, call it a storyline, right?
Sure.
Like, so I'll write it through. And so I wrote this long dialogue scene because I wanted a lot to play with. And I knew I was going to intercut and all this stuff. Somewhere along the line, because it was like, you know, it was a very expensive short and I was working a full-time job when I was making it. Somewhere along the line, I sort of forgot about the montage element, right? Like, I sort of lost the picture of how that was, the conception of that. And I started editing. And this was one where I was like editing myself, like from the assembly. And I was just having so much difficulty with it. Like, especially this beginning, I was just struggling. Every day I'd sit down, I like want to walk away from it. And I just couldn't figure it out. And a buddy of mine, I was talking to him about this. He was like a reality TV producer, but he had an Avid and he was like into this. He was like, well, he's like, I always wanted to learn Final Cut. Like, why don't I take it off your hands and try cutting something? And I said, all right. So he did, and he was used to Avid, so he wasn't familiar with Final Cut, so it was very rough. But what he did was he started with the shot that currently starts the film, which is like the Nazi who's blindfolded sitting in the back of the car as the car's driving down the road. And I hadn't conceived of doing that, and I saw this and I said, okay, everything he edited is terrible, like there's nothing wrong. I mean, he admitted it. He's like, I can't do this, like, because of technical issues, not because of anything else. But I said, but that's the beginning of the movie. And I went home, I literally went home and I cut the whole thing within like 2 days. And so the story behind that is, like, again, like, you come into it and you sort of have, you're following the script, you have this very preconceived idea and you sort of go, well, this isn't working, but I can't figure my way out of it. And sometimes it's good to step away from it. Sometimes it's good to have somebody else take a crack at it, you know, to see it from a different point of view than you do. And somebody might not want to come in and edit it, but certainly being open to new ideas and new things that maybe aren't exactly how you conceptualized it, except in this case it was, I just completely forgot about it. But then that can be that crack to opening up a completely new approach to whatever it is you're working on. And so that can be really exciting, and that's what excites me as an editor, because like I'm less interested in going into something and just kind of like by numbers, like doing exactly what I shot and I'm done with it. That's why I rarely do like master, close-up. Like, I really look at the stuff that I shoot as like it's a puzzle, and it can kind of only go together one way. And that's why I get so down into the weeds with like the frame fucking, because literally you're trying to, if the puzzle piece doesn't fit, it's not going to work. And people are going to be able to tell. They're going to feel there's something off about it, you know? And so that's what, for me, is very exciting about it, is like post as this whole new stage to discover and try things and sort of see what you've done from a new perspective is really, really exciting. And I think that that's why, that's what I'm interested in as a filmmaker in a lot of cases, is discovery. And I remember I did the movie that I, Be Somebody, which we shot in 12 days, also had a very contracted post period, which was a shame, because like when you shoot something quickly, you don't have a chance for discovery. And when you post something quickly, you don't have a chance for consideration. And a lot of times that's what you need. You need to have your thing, you need to watch it, you need to step away for a couple of days, you need to come back to it and say, okay, this wasn't working, you know? Yeah. And I think that that's what you lose when you don't have time. And I think what's really valuable to younger filmmakers sort of just starting out is the fact that that's all you have, right? All you have is time. Take the time to get it right. And take the time to learn what excites you and what works for you, because hopefully you're going to get to a place where, well, not hopefully, hopefully you will then be in a place where you're going to have a bigger budget, so you're going to have, you know, a more professional setting. What you're going to probably lose is time, and you're going to need to be able to count on those shortcuts and those skill sets and those, that work that you've done in the 10 years prior or whatever it is, sort of help get you through it, you know. And that's where taking the time now to play with things and try things can be really, really valuable. Then you develop your own tricks. You develop your own things that work for you that then come back and translate into how you direct and makes you, when you're in that situation where you have very little time, very little money, you know, and you're just trying to get it done, you can still make something that's good.
Great. Well, that's really all I have. So do you have any final parting words of wisdom?
Your first idea is rarely your best idea. I think that even if you don't want to be an editor, you know, or edit your own stuff. I think there's a lot of value in understanding that process and trying those things and doing it yourself so that, you know, when it comes time to work with somebody else, you have an understanding of what's doable. What's, mm-hmm. you know, you might not have a big background in VFX, but if you have an understanding of what's possible in VFX and what's not, especially at your budget level, that's going to affect how then you approach your scene on set, you know, and you're not going to be, oh, let's save it in post. And then you find out there's a $10,000 bill like attached to that kind of saving. So, you know, try everything, like, you know, learn everything, you know that like rarely are you ready, you know, with your first thing or your second thing or your third thing. And you get to a place where it somewhat becomes about the work as much as it is people seeing it. Don't sort of like balance all of your self-worth as a filmmaker on whether or not people are seeing what you're doing. Because when you're starting out, it's really hard to get people to care. Sometimes it's smarter to have one person see it and that person count in terms of your next job or your next thing than to have 10,000 random people see it. You're going to do a lot of shit. You're going to do a lot of crap. There's that great quote from Ira Glass where he's talking about the sort of gap between taste and skill. And that's extremely true. Even for myself, you know, like sitting on that panel, you know, like indie to mainstream, like I might be the most mainstream person on there, but I'm not mainstream. Like I'm still in the early paths of my career. You know, I'm constantly learning. And to think that you sort of got it right, you know, with that first film, like I did when I won the movie award and like thought that the keys were going to be, you know, handed to me in LA, sort of get your ego aside and really like focus on the work and focus on making great work and the rewards and sort of the bigger budgets and all those things will eventually come because people will always recognize good work and they're always looking for good work. But like, it's a long road. It's just as easy to get stuck sort of in a paying professional environment as it is to try and do it when you're working a day job and make films on the side. And so you're in a, you know, as young filmmakers, you're in a place now where you can really experiment. You can really try things. You can make things for you because eventually there's going to be a period where that kind of stops. And so take advantage of it.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. So thank you so much for being here today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. Remember, if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and rate us 5 stars because ratings help us find new people and let new people who stumble across us know that we're pretty cool. Also, if you say something particularly kind or funny in your review and you send a screenshot of it to podcast@stareable.com, maybe I'll give you a shout out in the future. Next week, my guest is Tom Pike, co-creator of Personal Space and the upcoming short film The Long Dig, where we talk about how to market your web series before you even have an episode to release. Until next time, I've been Bree Castellini, and thank you so much for listening. And thanks once again to Anna Eichenhauer, @QueerGermanGirl on Twitter, for the use of our theme music.